The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. And we've got a bunch of questions, Jim assures me. Give people a heads up, next week we'll be doing some focused Q&As on either taxes or Social Security. Not sure quite yet because Jim is going to be on his latest Ohio adventure, we'll call it.
Ohio, so Kentucky. Sure exactly. Don't forget Kentucky.
Okay.
I'm going to both.
Ohio, Kentucky area.
Kentucky, yes.
Adventure, yeah.
The Ohio River Valley area around Cincinnati. Let's just put it that way. Yep, that's where I'll be.
Okay. Are you going to walk across that big bridge?
Yeah, I'll be definitely. I've walked across the bridge several times. They have a big thing this weekend, next weekend in Cincinnati when we're there called Blink. It wasn't there when I have been there because of COVID. But apparently it's back. And I've been looking at video from 2019, because COVID hit in 2020 and they stopped doing it. It looks pretty interesting. And there's a big group of people getting together that I've been invited to on Thursday. And then they're going to meet on the Kentucky side and then walk across the bridge. And it's all lit up into downtown Cincinnati to see more lights and artwork. But I'm looking at the long-term weather. And I know I want to move because of rain. The downside is it tends to rain when you want to do something. Yeah. So that Thursday, they're already predicting rain. So I'm bringing an umbrella, but
you'll just need some indoor hobbies as well.
Yeah, I'm going to have to pursue indoor hobbies for sure. Moving to a location with rain. But no, I'm looking forward to it. And hopefully it will go well. So we'll see. I'll let you know. But I will be going down deeper into Kentucky. I'll be going to the Red River Gorge the second or third weekend I'm there. I forget. And I'll be hiking in the Red River Gorge area. Right outside of, I'm meeting the people I'm hiking with outside of Boone, Kentucky. I guess named after Daniel himself. And The people who are doing the hike that I'm going to tag along with have said it's kind of a historic area. So maybe I'll be able to go see where Daniel Boone used to roam around. I don't know. I've never been down there, but that's the area that I will be in.
Nice.
Okay. Anyways, anything else you want to say?
No, it's kind of... You're getting practice for cloudy and rainy kind of here this today.
Yeah.
It's kind of drizzly, at least in my house today. I guess it's stopped. It's dry out there now, but it was kind of yucky this morning.
Yeah, it's definitely dreary. It's it is good practice to what I'm getting myself into. I was in Boulder on Wednesday, and you know I do these social events in Boulder through a group. Folks, if you don't know, meetup.com, M-E-E-T-U-P, meetup. .com. Unlike Chris, who years ago when I told him about Meetup because I'm single, he thought it was M-E-A-T-U-P and that it was some hookup site. You don't remember that? I totally remember that.
That totally sounds like something I would say, though.
I laughed my hiney off when you were like, meet up? What is it, a hookup site? M-E-A-T-U-P? I'm like, no, you idiot. M-E-E-T-U-P. Meet up. It's clean. It's
one little letter difference.
One little letter difference changes the whole meaning of that website. Meet up, folks, is a wonderful way if you're ever traveling to meet people in an area or locally. I've belonged to Meetup in Colorado for 15 plus years, but it's throughout the United States. And you just kind of put in the city that you're in and you see all these different groups that people are saying, hey, this is my thing. This is what I'm doing. If you want to come meet me. So I do one. It's a happy hour one that I do in Boulder. And I do it about once a month. I used to do it more, but it's about once a month now, sometimes twice a month. And anyways, we had, before I left, I did it this past Wednesday, Chris, and I brought produce from my garden. I brought more tomatoes. I gave away 68 pints of cherry tomatoes over the course of my tomato season. So I bought some tomatoes. I bought my mini pumpkins. I bought onions. I bought tomatillas, all these extra stuff I had in my garden. I gave you some tomatoes too. I don't know if Mayanna gave them to you. But when I was there, it was a very nice evening. It was very warm, very nice evening. And people just were beside themselves when they heard that I was leaving shortly to spend 3 weeks in Ohio and Kentucky. Diehard Colorado people, folks, they don't understand why anyone would ever want to leave. They just couldn't understand why I wanted to move and why I was going to spend 3 weeks in the fall in Kentucky. One person said to me, you know, it rains there. That's why I'm moving. Because, you know, it doesn't rain in Colorado for the most part. Anyways, I just found it interesting. All right. I digress. I don't want to get too deep down there because I'm trying to implement, with the emphasis on the word trying, to implement some of the thoughts that our listeners shared with us in regard to the emails, two emails that were sent to me. One, constructive criticism and friendly, which we read and answered the gentleman's question. Another one, which was kind of rude. So I sent him a rude reply back, and I'm not going to go any further with that one. But I think it all keyed off of, Chris, a 45-minute answer I did on a Q&A show to one of the questions.
Yeah, a couple months ago, we had the final question of the show ended up going
long. It was me. Yeah,
too long.
It.
That one was too long.
Yeah. You texted me on that. You ripped me a new one, too.
I said 45 minutes on one question is too long.
Yeah, but I read between the lines. You were ripping me a new one.
There's only one line.
So we got two emails in response to that, and I read one of them on the air. But both of them, the rude one and the friendly one, was really pushing for Chris and I, first for me, not to repeat myself, and number two, don't go down rabbit holes. So I asked our listeners to please share with me your thoughts, because I figured if one or two people were really ticked off over that Q&A show where I went long on one of the answers, maybe other people are. Maybe people don't like the way I do things. And people have been writing in. We had 68 emails as of last week, and then I couldn't get to this last week, so I said I'd get to it this week. I didn't count how many I've received since then, but it pushes us way over 75, maybe close to 80. We did receive more emails. I do read every one. I've been trying to reply to them all. If I haven't replied to you yet, I'm going to. You just got to give me time. I am wicked busy. But some people did share, Chris, some very nice thoughts. So I want to thank everyone who shared thoughts. And this is the general consensus, folks. And this is what we will do on the podcast. Again, if we were to bell curve it with there being extremes on the left and the right, and the majority is the center of the bell, the vast majority of people, Chris, by far, hands down, want us to continue with the rabbit holes. Hands down. They have said repeatedly, this is why they listen. Some people have threatened to stop listening if we did go down rabbit holes.
Whoa.
So a few people And I don't have all the quotes in front of me. I'm going to read some of what people have said. But a few people pointed out to me, Chris, by doing the rabbit holes, they said there's been questions in the past that I would read and the people would say, oh, that doesn't apply to me. But rather than fast forwarding it to the next question, they would listen. And by going down the rabbit holes in the answer, we ended up involving scenarios that did reflect what they're experiencing. And that's the beauty, I guess, of the rabbit holes. People have said repeatedly in their emails to us, Chris, that they could get generic, simple answers anywhere. They value the deeper answers and the dives that we do. So rabbit holes will stay. And I think one of the persons, I'm going to read a couple of the quotes that people gave. I think this one captures a lot, Chris, about rabbit holes. He says, I thought the reason they called you bugs was because you go down rabbit holes. Please continue to explore the what ifs. Brilliant.
That is true. That's where bugs comes from.
For those who don't know, there was a fighter pilot. I don't know. Was he retired or an active fighter pilot? I can't remember anymore. I think he was active.
He was retired.
Was he retired? I don't know.
I thought he was.
But he just shared with us randomly in an email with a question of how fighter pilots got their little call signs. And I read the email and thought it was fascinating. It was like a week or so later, he gave us our own call signs because of that. And I'm Bugs because I go down rabbit holes. I wanted to be Bugsy because it sounds more manly, but that was voted down. And if you remember, that retired general wrote and said, you can't change your name. So Bugs it is. And Chris is Cowboy because he's trying to lasso me to, is it lasso or lasso or whatever? You're trying to rope me in and keep me from going off on these tangents. And you also grew up in Wyoming, hence Cowboy. Mm-hmm. So anyways, bugs and cowboys. So a perfect, obvious point to make. However, there was far more discrepancy on repeating myself. Now, the bell curve flattened a little there, and there were some people who wanted more repetition. Some people who agreed with me, you learn from repetition. One physician wrote, I don't have her email in front of me, highly recommended I keep doing the repetition. But I would say many people summed it up this way, Chris. We don't mind the repetition, but we also wouldn't mind if you did less of it. So I am going to make a concerted effort to repeat myself less because I do tend to be a little redundant and say the same thing over and over again, even though I don't think I repeat myself. That's a little joke there. Did you get it? See how I said the same thing in a row?
I was waiting to see what you were where you were headed with that.
It's not a joke if I have to point it out, but I just thought that was cute. I get it, folks. I do say the same thing over and over again. It's part of my teaching style, and it's part of how I learn. I will read an article several times over to make it sink in. And eventually I highlight just the important paragraphs, and then I read those several times over. It's the way I learn, and it's the way I like to teach. Ever since I don't know if I read it or heard it, that a person needs to hear something minimum of three times before it starts to sink in. But I am going to try to repeat it less. A few people did agree, though, Chris. They don't want you interrupting me. In fact, someone wrote, I agree with Chris. It would be annoying if he kept interrupting you to say you already said that. So I get that, folks, and I will really try to make a concerted effort. I think, Chris, if I hit number 4, 5, or 6, you can definitely pipe in and tell me to you know, move on. You said that already. Someone else recommended we go back to face-to-face recording. Because you could just hold up your hand and, you know, indicate.
And that's what I used
to
do when we were face to face.
Right.
Yeah, I could give him hand signals. I was thinking, and I guess we could have talked about this off the show, but there's the app we're using. If you're looking at your screen, I can just type in the chat there and say, hey, you're going long or, you know, too much repetition or something. As long as you check your screen every once in a while, you'll see what I'm typing.
True. I will try to do that. You can also try texting me. I usually have my phone on me, but then it's on Do Not Disturb, so that wouldn't do any good. But if you have to interrupt, you can, and people will understand. But the general consensus...
Ryan, come up with a really cool sound effect or something, maybe.
Yeah, shut the blank up.
That's the one I have handy.
No,
after a certain amount of time and repeating, I can...
No, a very light bell, ding. Just like that. That's a little ding. So you can play that, and I'll know, oh, okay, I repeat it, and ding. Yep, okay, got you, Chris. Big butts.
No, that's not it.
That one was, for those longtime listeners will know that sound effect. When I used to go down rabbit holes, I would answer a question and then follow it with but. And if it was a really big butt and I was going to go deep down a rabbit hole, we would play that sound effect. That Chris, this is a really big butt. Mm-hmm. And then he would play that. Anyways, now we're going down a trip down memory lane. So we are going to keep going down rabbit holes. I am going to try to stop repeating myself as much. And people would appreciate more questions. Of course, all this banter and explanation today might be hard. Someone did suggest maybe we could make a personal goal of taking the average number of questions we answer in a show and try to increase it by one each month until we get it to a level we're happy with. It might be something we try. I don't know. I'll leave that up to you to decide.
I like goals, but unless we correct the other things, that's just going to mean the show's going to get longer and longer and longer.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. Someone did, and several people pointed out the obvious. I prefer rabbit holes. It can be annoying, but I like learning all the nuances. So I just listen to the podcast at 1.5 speed. And other people have written that they listen to it at 1.25. I tried that. I listened to a couple of podcasts. So I tried listening to one at 1.5. I tried it at 2, and it was just impossible. 1.5, it goes by fast, but you got to really pay attention and listen. So anyways, that was another obvious thing to point out. Final thing, and it made me laugh, is the email from the second gentleman with the constructive criticism, and we were not offended by that email at all. And that got this whole thing flowing, was a very long email. And a guy wrote and he said, I thought it was funny that it took him so many paragraphs to tell you not to ramble. I thought that was cute. And then someone else pointed out, where is it? It was the same gentleman. He said, I also thought it was particularly ironic that you two spent 30 minutes trying to convince us the show doesn't ramble. So, touche. Well taken. And I'll end it there. But I do thank everybody who shared their replies. And if anybody else has suggestions or likes the status quo, don't hesitate to write and let us know. Just be polite about it. The one guy who just... You don't have to be rude and try to ruin my day. If you don't like it, just write to me and say, hey, can you kind of change this? I don't like it. And if you do like something, feel free to write in and let me know, hey, I really like that. Consider continuing to do it. I think hearing from our listeners of what you like, what you don't like, why you listen, why you don't listen is very helpful as we try to continue doing the show and maybe be able to even improve it. Okay.
Yeah.
Shall we get into questions? So we got two that I'm going to kind of wipe out with one fell swoop because they're very closely related. So it works out perfect there. I'm going back to July and June of this year. I'll read the short one first, and then I'll read the longer one. So on July 30th, someone from Tampa, Florida, hopefully he made it through the hurricane. I think Tampa got away pretty much scot-free.
Yeah, I think there's stormy there, but not a lot of damage in Tampa.
As it was in Fort Myers, and right next to my mom's house in Northport was flooded. Mom's made it okay. She had some damage. But anyways, he wrote, Bugs and Cowboy, Please describe the mechanics, advantages, and disadvantages of a qualified HSA funding distribution from an IRA. And then someone else wrote in June, and I'll read his email, folks. So that was email number one, qualified. We'll get into what a qualified HSA funding distribution, that has got to be the worst acronym that the Department of Acronyms came up with, QHFD. I mean, it's horrendous. QLAC was pretty damn good. QHFD, they could have came up with something better, hopefully.
Yeah.
Okay. So he says, another guy wrote, I enjoy your show, and I'm a fairly new listener from Marietta, Georgia. You mentioned on a recent show that you may focus an upcoming discussion on HSAs. And I did say that, and I don't think we ever did that. He says, the following is something I never heard about on any financial talk shows. Maybe you covered this in the past. I don't know. And he's talking about these qualified funding distributions from an IRA to an HSA. Chris and I have talked about these in the past. This is a new listener, so he didn't know that. So he asked us to share this with listeners. He said, I took advantage of this before I turned 65. It was a tax-free rollover from my IRA to my HSA. I did meet all the qualifications, being enrolled in a high-deductible health plan, not on Medicare. Unfortunately, my wife is not on a high-deductible health plan, so I could not contribute the yearly maximum for her, the family maximum. He was limited, he said. Yeah,
to the individual.
The individual.
Yeah.
I just want you to know this is a once-in-a-lifetime exercise. It's not the biggest tax advantage in the world, but hey, what the heck? It may be something you want to share with your listeners. So let's share a little bit, Chris, with our listeners on what these two people were talking about. If you have an HSA, health savings account, and that is a high deductible healthcare plan, it is not any high deductible healthcare plan. It has to be an HSA qualified high deductible healthcare plan. I have a high deductible healthcare plan that does not qualify as an HSA. I gave up my HSA one after my stroke because this other one had better benefits for some of the services, if you will, that I was going to be receiving. So I gave up my high deductible HSA qualified healthcare plan purposefully to get better benefits when I was being treated post-stroke. Pre-stroke, I had my HSA paid for a lot of the items, the healthcare plan. Post-stroke, I changed it. Okay. If you have a high deductible healthcare plan that qualifies as HSA eligible and you open an HSA, you are allowed to once in a lifetime, that's it, once in a lifetime, you can't do it every year, transfer the up to the annual contribution amount you are allowed to do for that year from your IRA to an HSA tax-free. Yeah. Why?
So instead, it's essentially a substitute for the contribution that you otherwise would be able to make. You're just electing to make that year's contribution from the IRA itself.
Correct. And why it's an advantage? Because money in an HSA will grow tax-free and come out tax-free if used for qualified healthcare expense, which we won't get deep into on this show. Chris pointed out what I wanted to mention. It is equal to the premium. So let's just say the annual contribution amount, not premium. Let's just say, I don't have an HSA anymore, so I don't know what the 2022 contribution amount is. Look it up real quick, Chris.
I think it's individual 3,600, but I'll make sure.
Okay. Chris is going to look that up. Let's just say it is 3,600. If you already put
3,650.
Say what?
I was off. 3,650.
3,650. So if you already put $3,000 into your HSA, you can't move from your IRA $3,650 and call it the contribution. It equals out dollars you put in. So if you put in three, you can only move $650. Conversely, if you moved all $3,650 from your IRA, you can't go make a voluntary contribution as well of $3,650. So it's not in addition to the annual contribution amount. It's in conjunction with the annual contribution amount. You're allowed to take it out of your IRA and move it into your HSA. As the gentleman said, it's not a major tax savings. It's not going to change anyone's retirement structure and all of a sudden take care of their healthcare expenses. It's just kind of a cool little thing you can do. And if you got a lot of money in an IRA, it's a way to get some money out. $3,650 if you're in a single plan, probably close to $7,000 or so if you're in a family plan. What I don't know, and I'll admit to it right now, I don't know if you're allowed to also move the catch-up contribution in.
I believe it is fine.
Okay.
Because it's just limited to the contribution you're allowed to make that year. So my understanding is it is. I guess as you continue to talk, I'll look if there's an exception for that. But my understanding was you would be allowed to do so.
Okay. Chris will confirm that. I admit I don't quite know if you can on the catch-up contribution or not. Anyways, fairly straightforward, simple. People do them all the time. We have talked about them on the podcast in the past. And I just thought since both these questions are fairly close, we would get to those. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, this next one came in June 5th, so we're getting through May, obviously. We're entering June.
Is it the Social Security question? Because we kind of skipped over that. We didn't do a Social Security up front like we usually do.
Oh, goodness. I totally
forgot. We can come
back
to it if you want.
Well, no, absolutely not. I do apologize, listeners. We usually lead with a Social Security question. So everybody's all messed up now. They're probably thinking, what the heck is Jim doing? All righty. Well, I apologize for that, folks. I didn't mean to steal Chris's thunder and not have a Social Security question lead in. So I'm going to go do a Social Security question right now before we get into other questions. This one came in from someone in the good state of... Want to take a guess? You got a 1 out of 50 chance.
Minnesota.
Close. Washington.
Real super close, yeah.
Okay, so this begins. Dear Chris and Jim, I like how he knows this question, Social Security, is going to you, so he puts your name first. Dear Chris and Jim. Okay, first, congratulations on the wonderful job you do. I'm an avid fan of your podcast. Why, thank you. I was hoping you might be able to clear up some confusion I have on the Social Security, and he has it in quotation marks, folks, grace year, quote unquote, grace year. My confusion stems from the belief that the grace year is something an individual had to proactively request or elect to have applied. I was under this impression due to Chris's blog posts. So he read some of your blog posts on that. Mm-hmm. I thought the grace year, or what's officially known as the monthly earnings test, is something the Social Security Administration will automatically apply if an individual applies for benefits under full retirement age and has one or more non-service months in a grace year. My question, is it the responsibility of an individual to proactively elect the grace year, or does Social Security apply this automatically? I'm not going to read the rest of his email. It's a pretty long email. You might want to begin by just explaining some of the terms, what a grace year is, what that monthly earnings test is, and things like that before you answer it. Just my suggestion.
Okay. Yeah. So the earnings test most people are familiar with, that's if you earn over a certain amount, your Social Security benefits will be reduced. And that's if you earn over a certain amount and you are under your full retirement age. There's a yearly, that's the default, a yearly application of what they call the earnings test. There's a specific rule that in a year that you stop working and you're below your full retirement age, if you claim Social Security, if it is beneficial to you for them to do so, they can apply the earnings test not on a yearly basis, but break it up and apply it on a monthly basis instead. And they call that the grace year, trying to give you some grace if you retired partway through the year and earned too much, but now you have no more earnings and you want to claim your Social Security. This is kind of a get-out-of-jail-free card, if that is the circumstances. As far as electing it or not, as long as you have been open with the Social Security folks when you do your application and told them about your situation, you earned X amount so far this year, you don't plan on earning any more, or you're earning a very small amount, a few hundred dollars a month or something like that from here on out, the grace year application, the monthly earnings test application, technically, he's correct, that's what it's referred to. Grace year is, they use that terminology too, but the technical application of the grace year is to apply a monthly earnings test, or MET. The system should automatically be entered to do that. Should be is the key here. And this is where I get into, I think you should elect it. And I share the same opinion that Lawrence Kotlikoff, who many of you know that name, he does a lot of information on education, educating people on Social Security rules, and he influences policy decisions, or at least tries to. He's an economist from Boston University, right? And ran for president last time around, if I remember correctly. That's not really what he's well known for, but he's very, very smart on Social Security rules and how things actually work. And his blanket advice is that you don't ever ask Social Security or assume Social Security is going to do something. You don't ask them for how to do something or what's allowed. You tell them. You do your own research. You come to your own conclusions. You figure it all out. And then you go and say, this is what I want. And please make sure that this happens the way I'm requesting it. Because unfortunately, a pretty high percentage of the time when you ask questions of how things work, or how should this work, how, what am I going to get, you get the wrong answer. And that's due to the complexity and I think issues with training some of the Social Security folks out there. There's many that are excellent, but there's an unacceptably high percentage of incorrect answers to questions when people pose them directly to Social Security itself. So it's safest. You have to be essentially your own proponent, your own guardian, if you will, and watch out for yourself, because Social Security is so important for people. You don't want it to get screwed up. So in this case, the grace year and really any other strategy or claiming decision that you're trying to make, you should be very explicit in what you're asking for. Make sure that they're entering it so that you get application for it. So technically, do you have to elect it? Not if you were open and honest about your earning situation for the year and you're confident that that person you're dealing with is putting the information in the in the computer correctly. Then it should work automatically. So, but there's the should work and the increasing the odds that it does work like it's supposed to. And you'll do that if you request it and have that open discussion with the Social Security person that you're filling out the application with. So I guess that's the answer to the question is should it be automatic? It should. And Social Security is pretty good about retroactively then getting records like earnings records and that sort of thing, and then realizing that they paid you too much or too little and then adjusting for it. But there's oftentimes a very long delay and it'll just kind of come out of the blue. So that's where hiding things from Social Security is not a good idea. We think that, or at least I think that you should be fully honest and open with them, because they're eventually going to get the records and adjust for it. So why have some surprise sprung on you later when they're going to withhold benefits? Just tell them up front what you've got, what's going to be going on. If your earnings change, reach out to them, let them know so they can make real-time adjustments and not put yourself in a position to owe them a bunch of money back, and they'll just stop paying you for a certain period of time. They don't just take it back from you a little bit. They're just going to shut off your benefit for a period of time if they end up overpaying you. And also, if you're not proactive, if you leave it to them to figure out things, you might be waiting a long time before they make you whole. Sometimes it can be, there was a slowdown during COVID. There's been people waiting a year or more to get resolution on something where Social Security owes them a few dollars back. If you'd been upfront with them and that it was processed correctly from the get-go, could have avoided all that. So that would be my advice, is be proactive and tell them, request specifically what you want. Don't assume it's all going to work automatically.
All righty then. So that's technically three questions, right? Because we got two on the HSA, which are two technical questions. And then this one. So
we only answered one. I mean, it was just happened to be two readers or two listeners. So we've only answered two questions so far.
Two? You won't count it as three? Yeah. All right. Well,
no.
To me, it's three.
Okay. We satisfied two people by answering their question, but we only answered one question.
All right. Well, let's get to number three. Mm-hmm. And this is from, I won't have you guess, it is from a Pennsylvanian. I should have made you guess because it could have said a state that touches Ohio, where I will be. But then it would have narrowed your choice down to, I think, like four or five. This is a Pennsylvanian. He writes, "Hello, Jim and Chris. I'm a longtime listener, a Vanguardian, a Pennsylvanian, and have gained a great deal of useful information from your podcast. I have a two-part annuity question. What is the difference between a deferred income annuity that I purchased for $145,000 with qualified funds from my IRA account and for which I specify annuity payments begin in 2 years, and a QLAC, qualified longevity annuity contract, which I purchased for the same $145,000 with qualified funds from my IRA, for which I specify annuitization begins in 2 years. He wants to know if there's a difference. And I'll explain in a minute, folks, what he's asking. Mm-hmm. His second question, how will the monthly payments from either a deferred income annuity or QLAC, as I described in part A, coming from an IRA, be treated from a taxation standpoint, and how will they be treated with respect to required minimum distributions? Mm-hmm. I generally appreciate your expertise, your dedication, your enthusiasm." Thanks. I'm the enthusiast, the enthusiastic one.
I get excited sometimes.
Yeah, like that last Social Security question that went on and on and on. All right. For educating your listeners, and if it sounds like I'm kissing up to, I didn't read this part. If it sounds like I'm kissing up to inspire you to choose this as the question of the week, well, I certainly am. Well, he sent this in June, so obviously he didn't get question of the week, but he did get his question answered, so that's good. It's really three questions he's asking because these are three separate things. So let's back up, Chris, to his first thing. He's saying operationally, folks, he's considering purchasing an annuity inside an IRA. I'm going to assume to generate a lifetime stream of income. That's why you would purchase an annuity to generate a lifetime stream of income with income beginning in 2 years. He does not give me his age, and this is going to play a little bit of a role in my answer. A deferred income annuity, folks, a DIA. Let's back it up. A QLAC, qualified longevity annuity contract, is a deferred income annuity, but every DIA is not a QLAC. So every QLAC is a DIA, but not every DIA is a QLAC. He's asking, what's the difference, Jim? I need to the income that $145,000 will generate inside a lifetime annuity. I'm going to buy it in my IRA, and I'm going to begin payments in 2 years. That's essentially what he said, folks. What's the difference if I do it with a deferred income annuity or a QLAC? Not much in his situation. Mm-hmm. Is it going to make a difference unless he's over the age of 72? Mm-hmm. And that would apply because of one key reason. What happens at 72, Chris?
RMDs, required minimum distributions.
Correct. If let's just assume, folks, he's 75. If he wouldn't be able to buy a deferred income annuity inside his IRA, the custodian of the IRA, which would be the insurance company, would most likely pick up on it and refuse to do it. Because a deferred income annuity inside an IRA does not receive one special treatment that a QLAC, which is a type of deferred income annuity, but it's structured specially as a QLAC, it won't receive a special treatment that the QLAC receives, which is with a QLAC required minimum distributions for that IRA or that IRA annuity are allowed to be delayed till as long as age 85. And the required distribution of any annuitized annuity. And remember, folks, I'll only say this once. An annuitized annuity is an annuity that you change from a noun to a verb. The noun annuity is just an annuity that's there. It's still your money. You can take it out whenever you want. Penalty periods notwithstanding. It's going to earn some interest as long as you hold it. That's a noun. When you quote unquote annuitize the annuity, you tell the insurance company, keep the money. Just give me income no matter how long I live. That's an action. Whenever you buy a deferred income annuity or a QLAC, you annuitize that money, even if the income does not begin right away. This listener is not going to begin for 2 years, but it's irrevocable. It's annuitized in the eyes of the IRS. Here's the problem. The deferred income annuity, he would not be able to delay for 2 years. Why? It's inside an IRA. And in my example, he's 75. He's passed RMDs. The insurance company's going to say to him, Chris, you can't do that. You can't buy a deferred income annuity and defer the income for 2 years inside your IRA. You're over RMD. You can still buy a deferred income annuity inside an IRA. There's nothing wrong with it, but it has to be annuitized immediately. You cannot defer it. He wants to defer it for 2 years. So he's asking, is there a difference? Conceptually, yes. If you are wanting to, if that two-year period falls within an RMD year, you're going to have to buy a QLAC because that's the only one that can defer it past 72.
Yep.
So I hope that makes sense. If not, I'm not going to repeat myself. Go back and listen. So he's asking, is there a difference between the two? Outside of what I described, there's not much of a difference. There is a slight difference in the sense QLACs, as part of their structure, will always return premium if you die before income turns on. So if you put $145,000 into a QLAC and died a year, you want to turn it on in 2 years. That's not much of a deferral period. You died a year and a half into it. Your premium would be refunded. If you buy a deferred income annuity, that's not automatic. You have to request the return of premium feature. If you have a return of premium feature, you get less money. I wish the QLAC allowed a non-return of premium during the delay period and let people decide, Chris, if that's important to them or not. Because if it's not important to you, you do get more money if you don't want your premium returned. Post-income, whole other story. Don't want to go down that rabbit hole. So that would be the biggest thing. Let's just assume, Chris, he's only 65. Would there be a big difference? No. You could buy a deferred income annuity inside an IRA. You're only 65. RMDs don't begin for another 7 years. You're going to turn the income on in 2 years. No big deal. Same thing with a QLAC. But I do want to point out to him, Chris, the L in QLAC stands for longevity. make sure you are going to live a long time. And it might.
How's he going to make sure that, Jim?
Well, make sure that you have a long life expectancy. If you have a short life expectancy, don't buy guaranteed income. That's what I meant to say. But I also wanted to point out to him, though, Chris, the deferral period isn't that long, 2 years. You might want to look at perhaps quotes for a SPIA, single premium immediate annuity, which could be delayed as long as 13 months. See if that gives you a little more money, or see if just holding this money for another year or two and then considering a SPIA instead of a DIA or a QLEC. Just kind of do a little bit of homework on that. You're not deferring the money
Shop
that
around.
Long.
Yeah.
Okay. His next question. How will the payments from his IRA be treated? Well, if you're buying it in a traditional IRA, Chris, what's going to be?
Fully taxable.
Fully taxable. If you're buying it in a Roth IRA, what's it going to be?
Fully tax-free.
As long as it's qualified. We'll put that little caveat in there.
Yeah.
So the taxation is driven by the account it's in. Roth or traditional? Pretty straightforward. Your next question, though, gets a little interesting, listener. The $145 that you will put inside your IRA, the payments out of it will be greater than your required minimum distributions would have been if that $145 was never put inside a DIA or a QLEC. They will be higher. The initial payout is only 3.7%. You didn't say if you were buying a second to die, a joint rather, not second to die, but a joint annuity or a single life annuity. But a single life annuity is going to have a payment substantially higher than 3.7%. So you will be taking out effectively far more in payments than the RMD would have been, which is a good thing, folks. He's trying to maximize his income, get as much income dollar for dollar as he can, and underlie it with a protection that no matter how long he lives, it will continue. He wants to remove, I assume, future interest rate risk. He wants to remove future longevity risk, investment risk. So he wants the annuity. It's a perfectly fine decision. But Chris, what happens? Can he use that excess RMD that he's clearly taken? Because the RMD of an annuitized annuity equals the entire payment from that annuity. So that RMD, Chris, is going to be a lot higher than what it would have been if he wasn't annuitizing. Is he going to be able to use that?
Well, he's going to be able to use the money that he receives. He can't use that, quote, and I'm doing air quotes here, excess payment above what would normally have been the RMD to satisfy RMD that would be required from other IRA monies he might have. Normally, if you take out extra money from one IRA on the left-hand side, it'll help satisfy the RMD from the IRA on the right-hand side. They're in the eyes of the IRS, you have one big IRA, even though you might have separate accounts of different custodians. When you have an annuitization inside the IRA, it works like Jim described. They make it simple and state, okay, instead of worrying about the RMD tables and calculations, we will say that whatever the annuitized payment is, that is the RMD for that account. Don't have to do any calculations. Whatever you negotiated with the insurance company and are being promised, that's the RMD. But if it's above and beyond, which it almost always is, what the RMD would normally have been, you cannot take that excess and consider it to satisfy other RMD dollars that you're required to take because of other balances you have in various other IRAs that you have. So just be clear. Just think of it as a standalone. Think of it as a standalone with similar rules to 401k RMDs. 401ks do not aggregate RMDs. Each one has to take their own. Think of your annuitized IRA, which a lot of times it is physically a separate one because you've opened it at the insurance company, and maybe that's the only thing that's in that at the insurance company. All your other IRAs might be more traditionally invested in Vanguard, Fidelity, Schwab, you know, wherever you, whatever custodian you might have those at. But 401ks, of course, various places, as you know, Jim, most of our listeners know, each has its own unique RMD, and extra distributions from one account cannot be used to satisfy the RMD from another 401k. So the rule is very similar to that. It essentially removes the aggregation of that annuitized IRA from the rest of your IRAs. It's off to its side, standalone with its own rule.
Okay. I was going to say perfect, but one of our comments we got when people have been writing in.
You say it too much. I say perfect. It's part of the drinking game, though. Yeah.
I say it too much.
There's a whole drinking game that surrounds our podcast. And
yes, you got that.
Jim usually does. After I say something, he usually utters perfect as his closing remark, I guess, or acknowledgement that I finished talking. Which I appreciate is recognition of perfection, but maybe not.
Well, I will work on not saying perfect. I'm trying to.
How about excellent?
Yeah, excellent.
Or sufficient. Or adequate.
All right.
How about so-so?
All right. Perfect. Let's go. Next question. Okay. Sure. This one came in on July 24th, as we all know, is my birthday. And this officially marks us answering all three birthday questions. This is the last one from July 24th. The other two we've already answered. This is the last one from July 24th. And this kind of applies, I think, to a question that you will want to answer because he specifically mentions you. And I have no idea what state he's from, but it begins, I just listened to your podcast about Irma. And I think you did a podcast about Irma right around that time that I wasn't on. I believe so, because I don't remember doing a podcast about Irma with you. I just listened to your podcast about Irma. And Irma, for those who don't know,
income-related monthly adjustment amount.
Oh, see, I was trying to read his acronym. That's what screwed me up. He has IRMMA. And I was like, wait a minute, income-related monthly. What's the
monthly
M?
Amount. No, it's two A's, right. IRMAA.
IRMAA, thank you. Income-related monthly adjustment amount. So I shouldn't answer this question because you just caused me to make a mistake on the radio. But he had the wrong acronym. But I get what you meant. It is an adjustment to your Medicare premiums if your income is too high. So he says, I just listened to your podcast about Irma. One thing that was not really addressed was how to plan for future Irma brackets. Chris mentioned very briefly that the bracket amount can go down, which was a surprise for me to hear. I have always been assuming that the bracket will stay the same as the most recent one, with the hope that they will actually increase it. Can you comment on this? So I didn't listen to that podcast. I apologize.
I don't recall saying specifically they could go down. However, they could. I mean, that is possible because they are controlled by those who made the rules, Congress. And so those Irma brackets could absolutely be reduced, capturing more people. Essentially, they went into Irma or went into this process in order to improve the funding of Medicare, which is actually under heavier financial stress than the Social Security system. But Social Security gets all the media attention. Medicare is more stressed than Social Security. In an attempt to shore it up, they created Irma to have essentially means testing of the Medicare premiums by charging higher premiums to those that have higher income levels. And they had a goal to capture a certain percentage of people in Irma brackets. And for the longest time, they stalled increasing them because they weren't capturing as many people as they'd hoped in there. So they just kept the brackets the same for a while until more people's income grew due to inflation, until they captured more and more and more people in there. But they could absolutely reduce them. Now, I suspect the risk of that is fairly low. That would be, I don't know if I'd even say that at this point. Medicare is under such stress, I could absolutely see them lowering the IRMA brackets. I haven't heard them talking specifically about that recently, but they have that possibility. What you can't assume is that they will grow regularly, although I think it's a reasonable assumption that there will be some inflation to the IRMA brackets. But it is possible. We have to admit that it's possible they'd lower it. Maybe Jim has a different opinion. We've never talked about this, so I don't know what he views that. But
I don't see them ever lowering it. If you remember when IRMA first passed, it had an automatic inflation adjustment built into the law, which they never allowed for the first 10 years.
Right.
And the Obama administration, and I'm not throwing the Obama administration under the bus, folks. You just have to look at what politicians say, even though half the time they're lying. But they said their goal would be to pull in 25% of Medicare recipients into paying premiums higher than, or at least subject to IRMA brackets. They want to pull more and more and more people into that. The easiest way to do it is freeze the bracket growth. Don't increase it for inflation. Don't increase it for changes in tax structure. Just freeze those bracket growth where they are. And as your income is going up in the future due to inflation or other items, it'll pull you in. The key to remember, pretty much most people listening to this podcast, you probably run a very good chance of being subject to IRMA in the future. And you have to really look at Roth conversion strategies, the cost of doing Roth conversions might push you into IRMA. IRMA only lasts 1 year. You have to qualify for it every year. So sometimes it may make sense to plan to deal with IRMA in the future by voluntarily going into it in the present. So keep your eyes on it. Keep your eyes on it when you have a widow-widower scenario. Oftentimes, income stays very close for some people, not all, in a widower or a widower situation where the income is very similar to a couple, but now there's only one person and the brackets have been cut in half, and all of a sudden the survivor is in a very high IRMA bracket. So IRMA is a constant thorn in the side. That's what I would say. But I hadn't listened to that podcast, so I didn't know if you said that they would actually be cut. But I doubt that will happen. This government is in debt up to their eyeballs. And Social Security gets all the attention. Medicare is the one that's grotesquely underfunded. So I just don't see them doing that. My thoughts.
Yeah, I agree that my gut is telling me that they don't need to lower it, because they can just be patient, and if they need to, they can stall the increases and keep the brackets where they're at or slow their growth to capture more and more people in. And it's kind of more of a sneaky, clandestine way of capturing more people without overtly lowering the brackets. So I do think lowering them is unlikely. But any of this stuff can change. Right, there could be a brand new bill proposed that makes all kinds of adjustments to try to save Medicare, and one of those solutions could be lowering the brackets. You have to admit that that's possible, but I do think worst case is likely to be keep them fixed and capture more people through growth over time. That I think would accomplish what they are trying to do without actually reducing them.
Absolutely, and that's what politicians have said they wanted to do. Not just the Obama administration, just happened to be said under that administration. They want to capture. And at the time it was 25. I wouldn't be surprised if it goes up to 40, 50, 60% of people they want to capture in there. It's exactly what they did in 83 with Social Security taxation. They passed it because Social Security never used to be taxed, as you know, Chris. And they started by taxing 50% of Social Security in 83, but they passed it by saying, so few people, look at these high amounts. You got to be earning more than $25,000 as a single person. That's no one's going to happen. It's going to happen to very few people. Don't worry about it. You're not going to have to pay. But they never indexed that for inflation. So today, I think the last I read, Chris, is well over 50%, if not 60% of Social Security recipients are paying taxes now. And they're just going to keep sucking more and more people into that unless they increase those brackets. And they could do the same thing with Medicare very easily. Just freeze them again for another decade or two. Okay, we beat that horse to death. Let's go on to another question. This question is going to be more of a rap session, Chris, than an actual question. But I liked it. It was kind of intriguing. So we're just going to kind of chat about this gentleman and what he's planning. It highlights an important thing. Our approach is just one way of doing things. You don't have to follow to the letter everything that we like to do or everything that we believe in. There's many ways to skin a horse. So don't think you have to do exactly what we say. And you'll understand what I mean by Chris.
Did you just say skin a horse?
Skin something. This is a fish.
A cat.
Skin a horse. Where the hell did that come from?
Well, out of your mouth, but just making sure that's what we're doing here. We're beating them to death and then we're skinning them. What do you got against horses, Jim?
Oh, they are evil, vile creatures. I will tell you that. But my day of horseback ride. Remember my friend who took me elk hunting up in Shoshone National Forest, sadly, before he passed away. And I had to go in on the back of this evil, vile creature called a horse. And he said if I wore ladies silk underwear, I wouldn't chafe and it would feel better. So I went.
Was that a joke that they played on you? Or
yes.
You actually did
so
that?
I went out and bought silk underwear, not ladies silk underwear. I bought a whole union suit made out of silk. I figured I'm going to protect my whole body. And man, did him and everybody at camp that night when we got to elk camp just laugh their little hineys off when they saw my silk union suit and the fact that I was in such pain still. That damn
you were
thing.
Still chafing.
That did nothing to stop chafing, let me tell you that much. But anyways, I have no idea why I said skin a horse. It's skin a fish or it's skin a cat.
More than one way to skin a cat is the phrase that most of us use. Not regularly, but...
Can we get to the question?
Yeah.
See, you waste too much time.
No. Wait a minute. I got enough emails that commended me on calling out the Jimisms that I feel obligated to do so now. So just wanted to let everybody know I didn't miss the fact that he said skin a horse.
Okay. Everybody.
But now you can continue. Now you can move on.
Thank you. Greetings, Jim, Chris, and the whole team. Okay, follow through again. It's not a specific question, Chris. It's more of an opinion. So he begins, hi, can you give more depth in regard to secure income to guarantee my minimum dignity floor in the early retirement period prior to considering using an annuity? Besides pensions, Social Security, and annuities, how would you create this income from age 60 to age 70 when Social Security begins without leaving a large allocation in cash or buying a multi-year guaranteed annuity, or MIGA for short, folks? I interpret that initial part, Chris, where he's asking more for a comment than a question. He's saying, hey, how do I fund what we call the delay period in my minimum dignity floor funding? He doesn't want to buy an annuity yet. He doesn't rule out an income annuity totally, but he specified, Chris, between age 60 and 70. So I guessed when I read this, he's going to retire at 60. 70 is when all his secure income is on, his Social Security, his pension, and maybe an income annuity. How does he fund the shortage in his minimum dignity floor during the delay period? Why don't you share a little bit about what makes the delay period so unique and why we personally say we're not overly worried about funding the delay period?
So let me first say the whole purpose of the concept of secure income is to protect against longevity risk, because we don't know when your life is going to end. So we can't budget with simple distributions from just a pool of assets and be confident that you won't outlive your money. Secure income comes to the rescue. We offload the longevity risk. The delay period has no longevity risk. We know when it ends. It ends, in his case, at age 70, when his Social Security and maybe other secure income is turned on. So we don't resort to using secure income during that time. Could you? Yeah, you could elect to do some kind of a period certain or a term certain annuity, which would be a form of secure income. I think that's overkill. That's not the way we would propose you do it, but that could be done. But since you know the end date and you start the period with all of your assets intact, we believe it's just an exercise in identifying the need and setting it aside. I think he's asking where to set it aside, but then he's painting us into a corner and say, but don't use these and don't use that. I don't know why you're so restrictive. I don't know why you're taking things off the table that you might want to consider. And what's wrong with cash, right? You need cash to spend to buy things. And if you need it in the next couple years, why not hold it as cash? I know as an accumulator, you're so worried about missing out on market opportunities and return or interest. There gets a certain point where it's far more important to have easy liquid access to it. And there's such a short time period, you're not going to earn a lot anyway, unless you're willing to take risk. And the whole point is you can't take risk because you need it right away. So I wouldn't dismiss holding what might seem like an inordinately large amount of cash. Is it going to be permanently like that? No. The amount you need to hold as cash for liquidity is going to be reduced greatly when your secure income turns on at 70, most likely. But in the delay period, you're covering all of your expenses, minimum dignity floor and fun, with simple distributions that you have positioned properly into safety, and the safety and liquidity of cash is perfect, in our opinion, for the first couple of years at least. Now, I understand not holding 10 years worth of cash. There, you can have you've got some ability to give up some liquidity, because you don't need it for a few years, because you've got liquidity by setting aside cash for two or three. Why not then put it in something that's still what we would call principal protected? You didn't mention taking CDs off of the table. CDs could be an option there. MIGAs are an option. But getting fancier than that, I think, is reaching for something you don't need to reach for and just overlooking the beauty of simplicity.
Okay.
So that's what I would say.
No, that's good. And I like it. And I agree with you. We structure our approach. I came up with my process in the intent to keep things simple, or as simple as possible. So he continues. So let's add a little bit more. A lot of what you said, Chris, ties into what he needs to consider. Again, folks, this isn't a question per se. We're just kind of sharing with you our thoughts on what he's thinking. And it highlights the beauty of this. You don't have to do everything to the T the way we prefer to do it. So he does say, I'm 59. My wife is 52. I want to retire at 62. So he adds some clarity there. I should have read on to that for you. So it's really going to be an 8-year period, not a 10-year period. No pension. Social Security will be delayed till 70. No current annuity. My current income is $630,000 a year. He didn't figure it out, but he wrote, I'm guessing my minimum dignity floor is about $150,000 a year. And then he mentions, folks, real quickly, and I won't get too deep, into his assets. He's got about $2.3 million in a 401k, $300,000 in a Roth, $3 million in a brokerage account, a $4 million fully paid off home, and real estate worth about $500,000. No debt. Kids' college is fully funded. So he wrote back the very next day and said, with the above assets, what options would you advise for secure income to fund my minimum dignity floor from 62 to 72? He's going to the RMD age. The delay period to us is when all secure income is turned on. And he has no pension, Chris. As of now, he has no income annuity. He never totally ruled out an income annuity. He did rule out buying a MYGA, but he didn't rule out an income annuity. So it's really only an 8-year delay period, even though he's saying 62 to 72. We would generally delay it to 70, unless, and he never wrote this, he's specifically planning on buying an income annuity at 72, but he didn't indicate that. So he then said this. Oh, goodness. Okay. Sorry, folks. I tried something new, folks. This is why it's messing me up. He sent this in two different emails.
This is why he always prints things out and uses paper.
I know. I'm trying to digitalize my life, so I did not print. I'm going back to printing. Because I copied and pasted his August 6th email to where I thought his August 5th one was, but I posted it under someone else August 6th, and I'm all muffed up. I'm getting out of this digital crap. I'm going back to paper. But I found his follow-up email the very next day to add a little more clarity. He says, my thought was to draw from my 401k during this period up to the 24% tax bracket. This will allow me to reduce future RMDs for the widow-widower tax penalty. I currently have a 60-40 allocation in my 401k. I will draw from it as long as the market remains within 10% of its highs. If there's a downturn, I should be able to satisfy 3 to as many as 5 years of my minimum dignity floor in my 60-40 allocation by taking from bonds. If the downturn lasts longer and I use that money, I could then use a reverse mortgage to pay back, a reverse mortgage to cover my minimum dignity floor and then pay it back when the market returns to its previous highs. I think he's getting way too complicated. Way too complicated, my personal opinion.
And could that complication work? It could. I'm not saying he's destined for failure by doing what he's saying, but I think he is overthinking, overcomplicating it for sure. I understand the 401k distributions to reduce RMDs later on. That makes perfect sense. But you can still hold cash equivalents and principal protection type of holdings inside of a 401k generally. You may not have true principal protection in there, but you oftentimes will have something like a stable value fund or something similar could be used for what we were describing before, which is essentially a form of positioning your assets to cover the delay period. Choosing to go and his thing about if the 401k is down 10% from his high, which that's true, it is almost for sure down 10% from his high, and then he says he can reach into bonds, but bonds, because interest rates are going up right now aggressively, bonds are falling, so the equities are down likely, the bonds are down likely. So that strategy at its face is already causing him to dip out of make distributions from things that are down, thus making the loss permanent. Whereas if you were pulling out of cash or stable value principal protection type of resources to fund this, you'd feel, most people, more comfortable because you're dipping into the pool that hasn't gone down.
I would want to point out a lot, because I agree with everything you've said. And I think he's trying to, what's the saying I'm looking for? Remember I shared it with you. If you've already won the game, why keep playing or something like that, folks. Mm-hmm. This gentleman has enough assets to cover his delay period. Whether it's an 8-year or a 10-year delay period, he has enough assets to cover it. Mm-hmm. If he only has Social Security and he has a $150,000 minimum dignity floor, that does seem kind of high, but he does have a $4 million home. He may live in a very expensive part of the country. His Social Security is going to come no way near covering his minimum dignity floor with what we call secure income. So he continues, I will keep my brokerage account 90-10, 90% equities, 10% fixed income for another 10 years. It should double if dividends are reinvested. Then I think I can mostly live off of capital gains for my retirement. Do you think this is secure enough? No, I don't. And I think there's a couple of things missing here. He is fixated, in my opinion, too much on accumulation planning and trying accumulation strategies, not recognizing he's going to go into decumulation. And negative cash flows can kill a decumulation portfolio. But also, you are creating a very complicated retirement. You're going to put a guardrail of 10%. Market drops more than 10%, I'm not going to take from my 60-40 portfolio. I'm only going to take from the 40 in bonds. As Chris rightly pointed out, that can blow up. It's blown up right now, and it could blow up again in the future. So your solution is to draw from a reverse mortgage. You have a home in value way above reverse mortgage limits that will be insured by HUD. So you would have to take a private reverse mortgage or stay tied into HUD limits, which might be a lot smaller than the value that you think you might be able to borrow. I'm not a reverse mortgage expert, and there's some out there, but it is my understanding the government doesn't let everybody just borrow 50% of the value of their home, which is the approximate value that most reverse mortgages can be. It's not like they're going to allow you to borrow $2 million. As part of a reverse mortgage, it'd be greatly reduced. And you may have to go into the private non-HUD insured reverse mortgage market, which will have significantly higher interest rates. And interest rates on reverse mortgages are already quite high. They are variable. You can get fixed, but they're high, a lot higher than mortgage rates ever were. And I assume now with mortgage rates rising, a lot higher than you probably think. So here you are, listener. You're going to someday be in your 70s and then your 80s, and you're going to constantly be watching the market, looking for a 10% drop, and then just taking from bonds, which you have to hope aren't also dropping by an equal amount like they are right now, so you don't fall victim to negative sequence risk, sequence of return risk, and a negative dollar cost averaging would have been a better way of describing it, selling more shares as they're going down in price to come up with the same money that you could have when they were higher in price. And then you're going to say, okay, well, I'm going to protect myself from that sequence risk by getting a reverse mortgage. And I know Professor Wade Fow is a big proponent of that and pushes that a lot. I admire that man greatly. He's far smarter than I will ever be. But he does receive compensation from reverse mortgage companies. I'm not saying that's the only reason he's writing it. I like his strategy of using a reverse mortgage. He looks at it as an academic, though, not someone who actually has retirement planning clients. And we do. And retirement planning clients will be looking at the reverse mortgage interest balance, seeing that growing maybe even faster than their market's recovering, and ostensibly going to allow them to take money out to pay that off in this perfect scenario that academics describe. And then you also, maybe not you, but other people, Chris, will eventually get to the point where they're not going to want to pay it back. They're like, screw that. I don't want to. So this money just came back. I don't want to get rid of that and pay off this mortgage balance and all the accrued interest. So they let it continue to grow. And it's forever going to subject you to these very strict disciplines that few people ever do. You don't stick to these disciplines. You may, listener, individually, you're a very successful person. You're making very good money. You're successful. You're probably very disciplined to get there. But a lot of people listening aren't. I'm not. And I do this for a living. So these types of complex strategies of watching guard rails and floors and tying it into a buffer asset of a reverse mortgage and then the discipline to pay it back, watching the interest of that reverse mortgage adjust higher and higher as interest rates go up, lower and lower as interest rates go down. But you're seeing all this compounding interest accruing until you can pay it back. Then having the discipline to actually cut a check. You got a $150,000 minimum dignity floor. What if you have to do the reverse mortgage for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years before your portfolio rebounds to a level where you feel comfortable spending from it again? Are you really going to cut a check to a reverse mortgage company for $500,000, $600,000, $700,000? I don't know. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. So I like to keep things simple. Because we know the end period, I don't understand the abhorrence to just taking this. You know you have to spend it on minimum dignity floor. That's food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care. I encourage you to actually figure it out and not guesstimate it. Actually figure out what your minimum dignity floor is. Listen to our shows on the MDF. Come up with, follow our strategy or one similar, but come up with a true MDF estimate. I think 150 might be a little high, but again, I don't know. I don't know your situation. His home is paid for, Chris, so 150 just seems high because it doesn't include a mortgage. But again, I could be wrong. Figure that out, what your true minimum dignity floor needs are. Multiply that by the 8 years or the 10 years that you want, and you can start positioning those dollars very safe. You don't have to always be worried about being out of the market, because markets giveth and markets taketh. And you're no longer saving. You are debiting and reverse dollar cost averaging or sequence of return risk, whatever you want to call it. Negative cash flows from a portfolio can decimate it in down markets. But also right now, you're getting some pretty good ways of being able to position cash-like holdings. I'm glad, Chris, you mentioned at least the first few years keep in cash. And I agree. And for cash, there are many cash-like options you can consider. There are some exchange-traded funds that tend to buy very short duration T-bills and corporate short-term bonds. There's money market accounts. There's anything that you can do that will earn more than the brokerage reserve accounts you'll get at most brokerage houses. And I think you should keep at least 2 years of minimum dignity floor there. But year 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, and 9 and 10, if you do want to go to 72 and not 70, those years, those dollars can be put brokered CDs right now. You can get a 2-year brokered CD paying a little bit more than 4%. You can get a 5-year MIGA paying 5.5%. You can look at some of the buffered products. I don't want to get into them on this podcast, but we will on a future podcast. Some buffered products, and I'm not talking buffered annuities with a 5, 8, 10-year hold. I'm talking products that unbuffer or unprotect your assets after 12 to 15 months. So you can protect them, but have the potential for higher rates and ladder a whole series of those. I'm getting a little deeper into some of the things we do when we manage portfolios in this buffering phase, not buffering, in this delay period phase, Chris. I just think he's making this way more complicated than it needs to be and exposed to far more volatility. What do you think of his post-delay period idea, though, Chris? He's going to keep his brokerage account aggressively invested 90-10, reinvest dividends. He thinks it will double over the next 10 years. So if you remember, he shared with us, folks, that his brokerage account had $3 million. He's going to double it in 10 years under this strategy of 90-10 and then live off of capital gains to cover his minimum dignity floor as he goes into his 70s, 80s, and 90s. What do you think of that approach, Chris?
Well, the living off of capital gains during that time makes me nervous because that's not secure income. And I don't have the email in front of me. It sounds like he's all over the place with his thoughts on what he might do because he said he would maybe consider an annuity down the road. And for his minimum dignity floor protection, I would probably consider that unless you, through your budgeting, have determined that there's no real conceivable way that you'd run out of money. If we've mentioned that before, if you have enough money and he's got, you know, you listed for me about $6.6 million of assets plus a fully paid off home. If they don't live such a lavish lifestyle, although I suspect it's fairly lavish if they have a $150,000 minimum dignity floor, but we have no way of knowing because he didn't share that with us. If the distributions are low enough where he's only taking out 2% of his, you know, portfolio at times, then maybe this whole idea that we promote isn't a good fit for him and is kind of overkill. But if he wants the safety and security of knowing the minimum dignity floor is protected, even if his other assets decline or go away somehow, then secure income needs to be back on the table. What you do with it between now and then is up for argument. I think assuming it's going to double in 10 years is a little rough because we have had 10-year periods in the equity markets here in the United States where you were net zero. That has happened. We had that decade here not that long ago where over that 10-year period, now that is abnormal, but could it happen? Could happen. Could happen again. So just assuming it's going to double and basing all your planning on that, I think is a little scary for minimum dignity floor purposes. Now, I think he's got enough cushion where he doesn't need it to double to be successful unless he has a really, really big fun budget intention. So we don't know enough. So we're making a lot of guesstimates here and we're assuming a lot of things. So we don't really know. But if we keep it just to the minimum dignity floor, I would probably put a little more effort into projecting what the minimum dignity floor is, look at how much your Social Security is going to cover or not cover, and then make a dedicated plan just for that. If you want to be more loosey-goosey and do some of these more exotic approaches to funding your fund budget, that is, at least in my mind, more acceptable, if you will. But I don't think you should. I think he's still thinking of all of his expenses as equally important. He's dismissing the beauty and simplicity of secure income in the long haul for minimum dignity floor protection, perfect, you know, specifically. And he's overthinking his delay period. I think his whole situation could be much more simple and still be quite successful. It's not like you need to be complicated and fancy to get the job done. He has done the hard work already. He's amassed $6.6 million. That was the hard work. He's got there. But there's a certain point where you either have it or you don't have it. If he's trying to live the lifestyle of someone who has $10 million, and the only way he can do that is to get a bunch more growth out of his assets even after he retires, I think then he's reaching too far. He's exposing himself to the possibility of disaster. If he's going to live within the lifestyle that the assets he's built have created, then why get it any more complicated or fancy than it needs to be?
Yeah, I'm glad you did mention, because I will agree with you. It is quite possible he will amass enough assets where the withdrawal rate is so low that everyone will admit there's no chance of him outliving his assets, even though in our opinion, it's not true secure income. We would not be against it. I just want him to know, removing as much emotions from a decision as possible during the delay period is the best way of doing it, because you will not think rationally when your $630,000 salary ends. It's going to freak you out, no matter how much in assets you've amassed. What you are describing is going to be subject to a lot of emotional decisions that I'm afraid you may not follow.
Okay. Well, just some food for thought for everybody, kind of how we view addressing the issues that he brought up. So thanks a lot, everybody, for sending in your questions. If you want to send in your own questions for future shows, just email them directly to Jim, jim@jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. How about next week? Next week, we're going to do a show or so with Bob, probably on some tax issues, and I'll probably get caught up on a few Social Security questions. We'll see what comes out. After that, I'm sure we'll hear how Jim's excursion to the Ohio River Valley is going.
Well, I'll be broadcasting next week. I promised my girlfriend I would not work all week. It's going to be hard for me, but I will do that. But the next 2 weeks after, when I'm still there, I'll be broadcasting from the Ohio area. And I also saw, Chris, apparently you were messaging me to shut the hell up and get going. Now I see what you mean. Yeah, there's a little message thing I could look at. So thank you. I'll try to look at my computer screen more.
Perfect.
All righty. Okay.
Thanks, everybody. We'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.